Hi, this is Matthew Craig. Welcome to the Allegheny Front. It's good to have you with us. About half of the nation's electricity comes from coal. A new documentary sets out to show how mining affects people in coal country. But getting the other side of the story proved challenging. We'll speak with the producers of the film about coal country. How will climate change affect a waterway like the Ohio River? That's a question the scientists are asking. We'll hear what they think. Taking notice of the old saying, build it and they will come, Ray Werner had a community oven built in Braddock and invited everyone to come and bake. That is all coming your way, plus much, much more, including a new installment of Earth's Bounty 2.0. So please stay with us. When the Senate picks up debate on the climate change bill, it will be, in part, deciding the future of coal as an energy source in the United States. About half of the nation's electricity currently comes from coal, and a lot of it comes from the Appalachian region. A new documentary film sets out to show how mining for coal affects the people who live in coal country. Julie Grant spoke with the film's producers.
Mary Lynn Evans and Phyllis Geller set out to make the movie Coal Country because they wanted to show how different people are affected by coal mining. They found lots of activists and regular citizens who would talk with them. Plenty of people were willing to show the thick black water in their toilet tanks. They wanted to show the black soot covering their cars. And they wanted to talk about the health problems they live with. And they all blame the coal industry. Evans also wrote to coal supporters to get their side of the story on camera. The answer?
No. That was the response. I mean, I sent out requests to the coal industry and to coal companies and to suppliers of the coal industry.
Evan's brother is a coal miner. He supports mountaintop removal. As we see in the movie, that's when coal companies blow off the entire top of a mountain to get to the coal. Many people consider it the most polluting and environmentally devastating type of mining. But Evans says not even her own brother would do an interview about it.
And when I said, why won't you talk on camera? I mean, you feel so passionately that, coal is wonderful and mountaintop removal is actually good for the environment as well as the economy. And his response to me always was, I would never speak on camera without getting permission from my, from the company I work for.
The filmmakers heard that a lot, and no coal miners ever did get permission to talk on camera. In the movie, we do hear from Don Blankenship, head of Massey Energy. He spoke at a public hearing about the need to ease environmental restrictions on coal mining.
We had nearly 800 employees up on Friday. We had to lay 8 off. I think that might be just the tip of the iceberg if we don't get some of our rules changed on how we mine in the state.
Anti-coal activists at the public hearing explain how the coal companies use that kind of intimidation to control miners.
That's the only way they could ever get support for how they treat their workers and how they treat this land. This would never happen in a place that wasn't poor. Never.
In the movie, some coal miners stand up at that public meeting to defend the companies they work for. One explains the coal industry has provided him a good salary.
For the last 14 years, the coal industry has supported myself, my wife, and my 3 children.
The last one of you so-called environmentalists, when you leave the state of West Virginia, when the rest of us move to North Carolina, turn out the lights. Oh, wait a minute, there won't be no lights. No coal, no lights.
The filmmakers want more Americans to understand that when we flick on the light switch, it's not a meaningless act. It takes electricity, and that takes coal. And as anti-coal activist Judy Bond says in the movie, coal is tearing apart West Virginia.
It is a civil war. It's families against families. It's brother against brother.
Or in the case of filmmaker Mary Lynn Evans, brother against sister. For the Environment Report, I'm Julie Grant. These are the worst times.
This week, people across the Appalachian region will get a chance to comment on a more closely scrutinized permitting process for mountaintop removal mining. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers will hold a hearing Thursday in Pittsburgh and in other towns. The Corps will accept written comments through October 26th. Last month, the EPA asked the Corps to re-examine the impacts of mountaintop mining on water quality. This controversial type of strip mining has already polluted or buried more than 1,000 miles of streams. the EPA, and Corps will review 79 pending permits. Coal companies call this additional review process an excessive burden that will kill mining jobs. It's hard to say exactly how climate change might affect a single river like the Ohio, but that's exactly what some scientists want to know. Kentucky Public Radio's Kristen Espeland-Gourlay brings this story on the future of a warming river.
Take your tow net on a long rope, toss it out into the river.
University of Louisville graduate student Allison Smith is collecting something nearly invisible from the Ohio River, zooplankton.
Zooplankton are small invertebrates. People would be most familiar with them as the food that fish eat, so they're an important link in that food web.
A web, Smith says, that could be threatened by climate change. Smith says an invasive species of zooplankton that's recently moved into the Ohio may fare better than the natives in the warmer temperatures she's observing, so she's running an experiment to find out. She'll put them in tanks together and simulate life in the river, in the lab.
I'm going to have three incubators at different temperatures, ranging from about 25 degrees up to about 32 degrees. And these are temperatures that are typically seen in tropical systems, but we're detecting those temperatures here in a temperate region frequently.
The idea is to see which organism wins the competition for resources at which temperature. Smith believes the invasive species will most likely be better able to adapt in the warmer temperatures. If her hypothesis proves true, she says the consequences could be dramatic.
Let me give you just one example. Another thing that's unique about this invasive species is that it has defensive mechanisms to prevent it from getting eaten. So it has this huge helmet on its head, a long pointy tail. So that means that they are less likely to get eaten by fish.
That's why this invasive species, Daphnia lemholtzi, could have a big advantage in the Ohio.
Now, if lemholtzi is able to competitively displace native species who don't have those defense mechanisms, fish will be having to rely on Daphnia lemholtzi, which they are able to eat less effectively. That could impact how many fish are able to survive and grow to adulthood, which then impacts so many other things, and they have these cascading effects up the food web.
Smith is contributing to a small but growing body of research into how climate change could affect freshwater systems. But scientists want to know more so they can start offering suggestions to local decision makers for how to deal with the impacts. The U.S. Geological Survey's Director of Water Science for Indiana and Kentucky, Bill Gertal, says we still lack some pretty basic data. Trends in river temperatures.
We are working on that right now with Fish and Wildlife, trying to look at what data we have available, and I have not seen the results come back on that information yet.
Gertal says he's hoping for government funding to help his researchers answer one of his top questions about the Ohio.
If you're going to assume that things are going to generally get warmer, what's that going to do to the native fish species, and then potentially what that could do to invasive species or a shift in the pattern of where the fish are, and will that cause you problems?
Gertal is a hydrologist by training, and he says he's also looking into how changes in precipitation caused by global warming could affect river levels on the Ohio, and ultimately navigation and even the availability of drinking water. Gertal says his research is aimed at helping people adapt to climate change. But Environmental Defense Fund conservation scientist Stacy Small says there may be ways to mitigate the effects of climate change on the river by restoring riparian or riverbank environments.
As riparian vegetation has been stripped from riverbanks over the past century, water temperatures do increase. The water is exposed to more sunlight. Riparian vegetation provides important shade that cools water temperatures.
Small says the Ohio River's industrial waterfronts have swept away some of that vital vegetation and left fish with less refuge from warmer temperatures. She advocates reclaiming those waterfronts with trees and grasses.
They have actually, in the face of climate change, a lot more value if restored to a natural state.
Cities along the Ohio have begun to reclaim some sections of waterfront, which could do more than simply offer shade to fish. Replanted riverbanks could help absorb flooding if the region sees more precipitation. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Kristen Espeland-Gourlay.
You're listening to The Allegheny Front. Coming up is Earth's Bounty 2.0, a new call-in segment with The Allegheny Front's Jennifer Shveta-Jordan and Big Burrito's Bill Fuller. To get your question on the air, please go to our website at alleghenyfront.org, or you can email Jennifer. Her email address is jennifer@alleghenyfront.org. And of course, you can always give us a phone call. Here's the number, 412-697-2936. Again, that's 412-697-2936. The Environmental Protection Agency has just announced new guidelines to overhaul the country's chemical policies. EPA Director Lisa Jackson calls this move transformative. The new policy proposals coincide with growing public concern about the harmful effects of chemicals found in items people come into contact with every day. The Allegheny Front's news analyst, Dan Murray, joins me to discuss the proposals. And the Toxic Substances Control Act of 1976 is the last major chemical policy set up by the federal government. Why does EPA head Lisa Jackson want to change it now?
Under the current act, the EPA has to prove that chemicals are dangerous rather than chemical manufacturers proving that the chemicals are safe. EPA doesn't have the right under this act to mandate that chemical manufacturers collect and report toxicity findings. And that lack of information makes it very hard to determine which chemicals are harmful.
And we should explain that we're talking about tens of thousands of chemicals, aren't we?
Yeah, at least 80,000 chemicals, everything found from toys and bottles to cell phones and medical instruments.
And also to clarify, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration handles chemicals found in food and drugs and cosmetics.
Yeah, that's right.
What does Lisa Jackson propose to change then in the Toxic Substance Control Act?
She wants to overhaul the act by doing a couple things. First, she wants Congress to pass a law that would switch the onus of proof to the manufacturers. And chemical manufacturers would have to prove that their chemicals are safe, and they'd be required to collect and report toxicity findings to the EPA. And secondly, Jackson would like to use existing regulations to prioritize chemicals so that the chemicals that are considered to be potentially hazardous are right up front, that they would be reviewed first.
So how would the EPA prioritize tens of thousands of chemicals?
Well, it's currently being debated by EPA, chemical manufacturers, and different environmental groups. The manufacturers believe that existing information about chemicals should be used for the evaluation and prioritization to speed up the list. EPA and environmental groups say that existing information really should just be the beginning.
And what else do they want to do?
They say that additional research is needed because so little is known about so many chemicals, and they believe it would be really difficult to evaluate and potentially ban dangerous drugs without a lot more information. Chemicals like phthalates and bisphenol A have gotten a lot of attention as potentially harmful, for example.
Yeah. How are those chemicals used in products?
Bisphenol A is used to make hard plastics like baby bottles, and phthalates are used to make adhesives like glue, and both have been associated with hormone disruption.
And how many chemicals have been evaluated and banned under the current act?
It's a small number. Of the 80,000 chemicals under EPA's purview, only 200 have been evaluated and 5 actually banned. That includes asbestos and dioxin, and lawsuits have really held that up.
Won't increasing the scrutiny of chemicals make it more expensive for manufacturers?
Yes, it will mean more research and reporting to the Environmental Protection Agency.
And then what have manufacturers said about the EPA's proposal to tighten up chemical policies?
At least in the press, trade groups have been pretty positive about the proposals.
And why would that be if it's going to cost them more time and money?
They said they're looking for consistency, and they'd prefer federal rules rather than a patchwork of state laws. And they've lost consumer confidence with some of the chemicals they have, and they want to regain that confidence and increase sales.
When will Congress introduce legislation to overhaul the Toxic Substance Control Act?
It could be as early as this month.
And before we wrap up, I do have a couple of questions about the Pennsylvania budget that was finally passed. How did environmental agencies fare?
Both the Department of Environmental Protection and the Department of Conservation and Natural Resources really took a hit. The DEP was reduced by $58 million, or about 27% of their budget last year. And line items that got absolutely no funding include climate change initiatives, the Consumer Energy Program, and an $11 million safe water effort. DCNR lost about 20% of their funding, and that includes more than half of what it spent on forest pest management and a little over $9 million from its state parks operations.
What are the repercussions of the gas severance tax not passing?
Many groups are angry because Pennsylvania is the only state without this kind of tax. And there is belief that this tax might have stopped more public lands from being opened up to gas drilling if it had passed.
Well, thank you very much, Ann.
You're welcome.
With Ann Murray, this is Matthew Craig, and you're listening to The Allegheny Front. Next week, food activist Raj Patel will be visiting Pittsburgh for a dinner benefiting the anti-hunger and anti-poverty group Just Harvest. The Allegheny Front's Jennifer Shveta-Jordan speaks with Patel.
Raj Patel's written one of the most provocatively titled food books on the market today. It's called Stuffed and Starved: Markets, Power, and the Hidden Battle for the World Food System. He's a visiting professor at the University of California in Berkeley's Center for African Studies. And he's one of dozens of scholars on that campus exploring the challenges of modern agriculture. He was here as a protester at the recent G20 International Summit in the city. Patel says the world leaders said far too little about world hunger at that meeting.
Twice as many people are affected by the fact that food is much more expensive and their incomes are much lower than are directly affected by the financial crisis. What we didn't hear from our leaders was any sort of appreciation of the scale of this financial crisis is causing.
Patel isn't the only critic of food policy who's coming to Pittsburgh. The even better known author of such books as Omnivore's Dilemma, Michael Pollan, will speak at the Bioneers Conference. There are also other speakers in the region and events coming up. Links are at AlleghenyFront.org. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Jennifer Shveta-Jordan.
You can listen to the entire 15-minute version of Jennifer's interview with Patel at AlleghenyFront.org.
The Allegheny Front is supported by the Heinz Endowments. The Environment Report is a production of Michigan Radio. Support comes from the USDA's Cooperative Extension Service, the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation, and the Americana Foundation. You can find photos and transcripts at environmentreport.org.
About one evening a month in a working-class steel mill town a few miles outside of Pittsburgh, residents gather around an outdoor oven. It's the work of a community activist who took bricks from abandoned homes and reworked them into a baking kiln, the showpiece of what he hopes will be a kind of neighborhood center. The Allegheny Front's Caitlin Malangowski reports.
Across the street from the huge Mon Valley Steelworks, Ray Werner pulls open the wooden door to a much smaller kiln, the Braddock Community Oven. It's about 8 feet tall, made mostly of brick and mortar. Werner, the mastermind behind the project, says ovens do more than just cook food. They bring people together.
What happens in a community with a brick oven is what has happened over the centuries. And just as people sit around a campfire, and what happens? You start to share songs. You start to share stories. You share hot dogs and marshmallows and other food. You share families. And it doesn't matter where you come from, what your level of income is, you know, what color you are, what religion you are, none of that matters. And it's always moments that you remember when you grow up.
The oven was first fired up last year. Since then, there have been public readings and photography exhibitions. There have even been opportunities for residents to try their hands at baking. Residents like Trevor Cruxton, who works in Braddock.
I did try making a pizza. It was a pear and gorgonzola cheese pizza. And I learned that It's not as easy as it looks to just throw a pizza in there and have it come out looking and tasting right.
Cruxton says his pizza came out as a big doughy blob because the oven wasn't hot enough. The oven takes a few hours to properly heat up. That's why today, Werner is giving a mock demo of the oven. Normally, it needs to be around 700 degrees for pizzas and breads, and around 1500 degrees for meats. He scrapes a large metal spatula on brick.
You know, you have a little peel that we do in there. And you keep moving the pizza around so the one end doesn't burn. But after you get onto it, it's like, you know, it's not brain surgery. It's just a lot of fun.
The The oven does more than make pizza. Braddock Mayor John Fetterman says the oven's presence revitalized a vacant lot full of weeds.
The land where it's located was just horribly overgrown and just a real mishmash of vegetation and debris. And coincidentally, around that time, we had to take down this small garage that was in danger of falling down. And we had all these blocks. We had these bricks from the building next door to it. So we had all this raw material, if you will, from this garage that we had to dismantle. We had a mason, a local mason, and we had the land. So it was kind of, and the idea. So it was like this really perfect kind of convergence.
Fetterman says it's made Braddock a better place. And it's a great feature. But it wasn't like all of the town's problems disappeared once it was erected.
It's not going to, like, change everything overnight, of course, and it was never intended to. It was just, it's intended to be, like, a really nice amenity, low-cost addition to a community plan that just kind of adds a really nice set of possibilities and opportunities to have the community come together.
Fetterman says he would encourage any neighborhood to build a community oven. Between labor, clearing the area, and zoning approval, it cost their town around $2,000. The lot holding the Braddock oven also contains a fire pit, brick chairs, and a flower garden. Werner says the construction and use of the oven are like one big recycling project, since he burns discarded wood and uses no gas or electricity. Werner and Fetterman both hope the oven concept catches on in other communities, well, like wildfire.
We think that it's a certain kind of glue for inner city communities. It's not expensive to do. They have the property, and they need it more than other communities in Pittsburgh.
Though community ovens are popping up around the country, and in chilly Toronto, Werner wants Pittsburgh to have a leading edge in the community oven scene. The effort does seem to be on the rise, with two being built in other city neighborhoods. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Caitlin Nalangowski.
Earth Bounty 2.0 is sponsored by the East End Food Co-op. The co-op is a member-owned natural foods grocery store open to the public, specializing in local and organic produce, meats, and dairy. The East End Food Co-op also features a vegetarian cafe, fair trade espresso bar, supplements, herbs, and bulk foods. More information is available at eastendfood.coop.
I'm Jennifer Shveta-Jordan for the Allegheny Front, and you're listening to a new-ish segment that I'm doing with Bill Fuller, corporate chef of Big Burrito Restaurant Group, which has a variety of fine and casual eateries in the region. Hello, Bill.
Hi, Jennifer. How you doing?
Our segment is Earth's Bounty 2.0. It's about food and the environment. And the number is 412-697-2936. And you can also email your food questions to me at jennifer@alleghenyfront.org.
And we love funky questions, interesting questions.
About food and the environment.
About food and the environment. Yeah, I can't really help you with your physics homework.
So we have in the studio with us today a local celebrity.
Woo!
Cindy Howes of WYUP FM, where we produce the show. Bill is a big fan, right?
I am. I'm very excited. I kind of have, I have started to stalk Cindy.
It seems like a safe stalking.
Yeah.
Because I'm a fan of what you do, so.
So we can kind of stalk each other?
Yeah.
That's fine.
Does that mean you guys are on Twitter following? Is that what you're talking about?
We do follow each other on Twitter. Okay. I follow you. Do you follow me? I don't think you follow me.
I can't remember. No. I will now.
Okay, come on. Let's talk about food.
Okay.
I thought Cindy could throw out some food songs. Maybe you guys could somehow put together a soundtrack and a menu for a dinner somebody might make right now with things that they could get at the farmer's market, say, this week.
Farmer's market this week, it's fall apples.
Well, we could go with a band like the Apples in Stereo if you want to do a band. Or there's a singer-songwriter who I really enjoy from New York. Her name is Anna Egge, and she has a song called The Apple Tree.
That's perfect.
So what would I make with the apples?
Yeah.
Well, I think it'd be kind of fun to take like a tart apple and then grate it and put some cilantro and mint and fish sauce and some chilies and a little bit of toasted rice on it.
No, that's obscure.
I went with obscure. Make like a Thai green mango salad, but with green tart apples.
Funky. Okay.
And there's lots of squash in the market. Butternut squash, pumpkins, Lots of squash. People don't sing about
Smashing
squash.
Pumpkins is Smashing obvious, pumpkins. Right?
Wow. Wow, that's an obvious one.
Well, also, if I mean, this is kind of stretching it, but instead of squash, you could go with like a song from the band Squeeze.
Wow.
Just throwing that out there.
That's cool.
Pulling mussels from the shell. Could you do something
easy,
with mussels?
Easy money. That's great.
Mussels, they're coming in season, right? The months that end with R, isn't that true? That's not true?
That's a whole crazy thing.
Oh.
That's a whole tangent.
Maybe one more.
Well, peach is ended. That's a lot. There's a lot of peach stuff, though. Isn't there?
Yeah, there's that that song for the Presidents of the United States of America. Do you
know
that song?
That's too easy. Millions of peaches.
Come on, it's good,
Millions of peaches.
Peaches come from a can, except not when you buy them at the local farmer's market.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's good. You're right. I just listened to that. I heard that like a week or two. Song. No, well, don't they say local market, don't they?
They do not. No, it's peaches come from a can. They were put there by a man in a factory downtown.
Moving to the country, I'm gonna eat a lot of peaches. I'm moving to the country, I'm gonna eat me a lot of peaches. I'm moving to the country, I'm gonna eat a lot of peaches. I'm moving to the country, I'm gonna eat a lot of peaches.
This is great. This is all I've just actually fulfilled the whole purpose to meet now. Amazing famous DJs now. I can leave.
So it's working.
Yeah, it's working.
Well, thank you so much.
Thanks,
Cindy.
All right. See you guys.
Okay.
So, Bill, are you going to come back to record some more Allegheny Front Earth's Bounty with me? Because you've talked to Cindy already.
Yeah, I'm good. I'm good. My infiltration into WYAP and Allegheny Front has resulted in me meeting Cindy Howes, and I'm successful in my mission. So
please, will you come back, please?
Maybe if someday she comes in again.
Maybe if we got more calls.
If we got more calls.
If you, the listener, would interact with us, we would, maybe Bill would come back. Well, anyway, the number is 412-697-2936. You can Twitter as well. What do you call it? Twitter?
Tweet us.
Allegheny Front, or email me, jennifer@alleghenyfront.org, with your questions on food and the environment for Big Burrito's corporate chef, Bill Fuller, or me. Jennifer Shveta Jordan. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, and eat well.
Millions of peaches, peaches for me. Millions of peaches, peaches for free. Millions of peaches, peaches for me. Millions of peaches, peaches for free. Look out!
Thanks for joining us here at the Allegheny Front. Produced in the studios of WYEP-FM in Pittsburgh. If you have any comments or ideas that you'd like to share, please send them along to 67 Bedford Square, Pittsburgh, PA, 15203. Our email address is info@alleghenyfront.org. Our programs are archived and available on our website, alleghenyfront.org. The Environment Report is a production of Michigan Radio. Support comes from the Joyce Foundation, the George Gund Foundation, and Great Lakes Michigan Trust. Tim Prevost wrote and performed our theme music. Our technical director is Jennifer Shveta Jordan, with production assistance by Joey Spihar. The executive producer of the Allegheny Front is Kathy Nauer. I'm Matthew Craig. We'll see you again next week for another edition of the Allegheny Front. And until then, go well with good blessings.